Part 2, Chapter 2, Corruption of Early Christianity. Quote, "And it came to pass that I saw among the nations of the Gentiles the formation of a great church. And the angel said unto me, Behold, the formation of a church, which is most abominable above all other churches, which slayeth the saints of God, yea, and tortureth them, and bindeth them down, and yoketh them with a yoke of iron, and bringeth them down into captivity. And it came to pass that I beheld this great and abominable church, and I saw the devil, that he was the founder of it. And I also saw gold and silver and silks and scarlets and fine twined linen and all manner of precious clothing. And I saw many harlots. And the angel spake unto me, saying, Behold the gold and the silver and the silks and the scarlets and the fine twined linen and the precious clothing and the harlots are the desires of this great and abominable church. And also for the praise of the world do they destroy the saints of God, and bring them down into captivity. Thou seest the formation of that great and abominable church, which is most abominable above all other churches. For behold, they have taken away from the gospel of the Lamb many parts which are plain and most precious. And also many covenants of the Lord have they taken away. And all this have they done, that they might pervert the right ways of the Lord, that they might blind the eyes and harden the hearts of the children of men." Unquote. 1 Nephi, chapter 13, verses 4 through 9 and 26 and 27. The Great and Abominable Church. It would probably be highly remiss of me to create an entire volume focusing on exposing the Luciferian Church, and yet say nothing about the Roman Catholic Church, since it is the organization which, historically and descriptively, most closely resembles that which the angel discusses with Nephi. However, what few LDS tend to comprehend is that the Roman Catholic Church is presented as this great and abominable church in and of itself. The Catholic Church and the fractional Christian organizations that have derived from it, even those highly critical of it, are not the whole of Mystery Babylon, nor the Church of the Devil. They are merely one of the greater, more obvious divisions of it. Perhaps the best quote I've come across by any general authority which most briefly and succinctly defines what the Luciferian Church is, what Mystery Babylon is as a whole, is the following quote from John Taylor, the third president, prophet, seer, and revelator of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Quote, "Babylon, literally understood, is the gay world, spiritual wickedness, the golden city, and the glory of the world. The priests of Egypt, who received a portion gratis from Pharaoh, the priests of Baal, and the Pharisees and Sadducees, with their long robes among the Jews, are equally included in their mother's family, with the Roman Catholics, Protestants, and all that have not had the keys of the kingdom and power thereof, according to the ordinances of God." End quote. Footnote 1. Additionally, what is most important to understand regarding all such groups within Mystery Babylon is that each of them originates with, and at its core resides, a mystery school. No matter how publicly visible the organization is, at its center is a secret, or at least relatively secret, leadership hierarchy. And there is always a form of initiation which requires an oath of loyalty and secrecy to enter within the ranks of such hierarchy. Also, there are always layers upon layers of hierarchic management within these schools. Often the initiates of an outer layer will have no idea that there are other layers above or within the one directly superior to them. Hence, the symbology of the rose, with its unfolding layers of petals, is frequently used by many branches of the mystery schools. It is a perfect representation of both the organizational structure as well as the concept of layered secrecy, concealing the existence of each of the inner layers. While I have been unable to discover any whistleblower testimony concerning additional hierarchy layers within the Catholic Church, it is more than reasonable that the Pope and other leaders directly below him are merely an external layer, and that there resides further secret inner layers of power within the Vatican, likely involving the Jesuits of the Society of Jesus and or Opus Dei. A significant portion of rumors concerning secret societies within the Catholic Church center upon the Jesuits, who are purported to function as an elite enforcement and espionage group. Quote, "The Society of Jesus is a Christian male religious order that follows the teachings of the Catholic Church. The members are called Jesuits and are also known colloquially as God's Marines and as the Company." These being references to founder Ignatius of Loyola's military background and members' willingness to accept orders anywhere in the world and live in extreme conditions. The Jesuits today form the largest single religious order of priests and brothers in the Catholic Church. Opus Dei has been described as the most controversial force within the Catholic Church. According to several journalists who researched Opus Dei separately, most of the criticism against Opus Dei are mere myths created by its opponents, and Opus Dei is considered a sign of contradiction. Several popes and other Catholic leaders have endorsed what they see as its innovative teaching on the sanctifying value of work and its fidelity to Catholic beliefs. In 2002, Pope John Paul II canonized Escriva, the founder of Opus Dei, and called him the saint of ordinary life. Controversies about Opus Dei have centered on criticisms of its alleged secretiveness, its recruiting methods, the alleged strict rules governing members, the practice by celibate members of mortification of the flesh, its alleged elitism and misogyny, the alleged right-leaning politics of most of its members, and the alleged participation by some in authoritarian or extreme right-wing movements, especially the Francoist government of Spain until 1978. Within the Catholic Church, Opus Dei is also criticized for allegedly seeking independence and more influence. Much public attention has focused on Opus Dei's practice of mortification, the voluntary offering up of discomfort or pain to God. This includes fasting, or in some circumstances, self-inflicted pain such as self-flagellation. Mortification has a long history in many world religions, including the Catholic Church. Additionally, Opus Dei celibate members practice corporal mortifications, such as sleeping without a pillow or sleeping on the floor, fasting, or remaining silent for certain hours during the day. Critics state that self-mortification is a startling, extreme, and questionable practice, one that borders on masochism. End quote. Footnote 2. Amazingly, there are no fewer than 132 official Catholic religious orders or societies in existence, of which the Jesuits and Opus Dei seemingly only scratch the surface. Footnote 3. Compelling testimony from witnesses and victims claiming Jesuit involvement in horrendous crimes against humanity is covered in Part 5, Volume 2. Additionally, there is a document being circulated around the Internet which purports to be a valid transcript of a Jesuit oath for those initiated into the Knights of Columbus. The source of this oath transcript is from the U.S. Congressional Record dated February 15, 1913, on pages 3215 and 3216. A scan of these pages is provided in the supporting material. Footnote 4. However, it was entered into the record as part of a complaint by a candidate for public office, who insisted that it is a fabrication and hoax which was being circulated by his opponent near the time of election. This was done in an attempt to derail his campaign and generate fear in the populace because he is a Catholic. Therefore, despite this oath being in the congressional record, its veracity is wholly unverifiable. The likeliness of it being unreliable and erroneous is very high. There is one historical figure who is connected to the Jesuits, whose evil works are tremendously relevant today, Adam Weishaupt, who founded the Order of the Bavarian Illuminati on May 1, 1776. He was reportedly a Jesuit, yet some sources say that he apostatized. Others say he formed the Bavarian Illuminati under orders of his superiors. Because information regarding Weishaupt is readily available in numerous other sources of conspiracy literature, I shall not cover him in this book. However, I wish to emphasize that due to there being a tremendous focus on Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati, I fear that its overall role and influence in historical conspiratorial matters is resoundingly overstated. There are far more numerous, more dominant, more influential, and more widespread organizations abounding in this world, which are touched upon in Part 3 of this book. Weishaupt and his Bavarian Illuminati are merely a drop in the Mystery Babylon bucket. All in all, though, the external Roman Catholic Church, that the members and the rest of the world witness each and every day, functions not unlike a decoy, an attention diversion. It is a terrifically garish veneer among the divisions of Mystery Babylon. There are plenty of credible books and resources one can locate with extensive historical accounts of the pagan roots and atrocities committed by the Catholic Church and its clergy over the centuries. Not to mention the pedophilia scandals that began surfacing in the 1980s, later to explode in number from 2001 on, resulting in numerous lawsuits, all settled out of court. Footnote 5. As covered in the next section, where there's smoke, there's mirrors, meaning that whenever rumors and whisperings, i.e. smoke, are surfacing about hidden evil deeds, i.e. fire, a concentrated, organized conspiratorial effort is made to deflect, disrupt, discredit, and dismiss, i.e. mirrors, any efforts to ascertain and investigate into the matter. Evidence is purposefully lost, contaminated, or made irrelevant. Whistleblowers are silenced, discredited, or their testimonies are attacked, and concerned citizens are placated. Philosophic, Gnostic, and mystic infiltration of the early Christian Church. The primary forces which brought about the apostasy of the ancient church and the rise of the Roman Catholic Church were the infiltration and overriding influence of initiates of a variety of mystery school groups, primarily the mystics, the Gnostics, and the Greek philosophers. The leaders of the ancient church strenuously tried to keep heresies that were being introduced by such wolves in sheep's clothing from corrupting sound doctrine and being adapted by the general membership. As one reads Paul's epistles in the New Testament, addressed to the various church bodies and leaders, one can get a sense of his exasperation in keeping such false doctrines from creeping in and taking hold. However, by the 4th century, the situation was pretty much hopeless. The apostles were dead, with the exception of John the Beloved, and none were ordained in their place. The other leaders were disagreeing amongst themselves, and eventually local bishops were recognized as authoritative, to speak for and act in behalf of the remaining organization. Many of the gifts of the Spirit had been removed from the earth. It was in this condition that the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD commenced. Quote, "The first Council of Nicaea was a council of Christian bishops convened in Nicaea of Bithynia, present-day Iznik in Turkey, by the Emperor Roman Constantine I in AD 325. This first ecumenical council was the first effort to attain consensus in the Church through an assembly representing all of Christendom. Its main accomplishments were settlement of the Christological issue of the nature of Jesus and his relationship to God the Father, the construction of the first part of the Creed of Nicaea, settling the calculation of the date of Easter, and promulgation of early canon law. The First Council of Nicaea is the first ecumenical council of the Catholic Church. Most significantly, it resulted in the first extra-biblical uniform Christian doctrine, called the Creed of Nicaea. But the creation of the Creed, a precedent was established for subsequent local and regional councils of bishops, synods, to create statements of belief and canons of doctrinal orthodoxy, the intent being to define unity of beliefs for the whole of Christendom. The council did not create the doctrine of the deity of Christ, as is sometimes claimed, but it did settle, to some degree, the debate within the early Christian communities regarding the divinity of Christ. This idea of the divinity of Christ, along with the idea of Christ as a messenger from God the Father, had long existed in various parts of the Roman Empire. The divinity of Christ had also been widely endorsed by the Christian community in the otherwise pagan city of Rome. End quote. Footnote 6. Recall what the Lord communicated to Joseph Smith during the first vision. Quote, I was answered that I must join none of them, for they were all wrong. All their creeds were an abomination in his sight, that those professors were all corrupt, that they draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof. End quote. Footnote 7. Saint Augustine and the End of the Ancient Church of Christ. One of the greatest resources available that gives a thorough and concise historical synopsis of the erosion of the ancient church, which Christ and the original apostles founded, is contained in the works of Hugh Nibley, specifically his book, The World and the Prophets, and his collection of radio lectures given in the early 1950s titled, Time Vindicates the Prophets. In one particular chapter of The World and the Prophets, Nibley focuses on St. Augustine and his significant role in creating a formal dogma that melds together the teachings of Christ with the pagan beliefs and exoteric spiritual arguments of the Greek schools. The following are segments of this chapter. Quote, Catholic and Protestant authorities vie in proclaiming their incalculable debt to St. Augustine, the man who laid the foundation of Western culture, who stands between the ancient world and the Middle Ages as the first great constructive thinker of the Western Church, and the father of medieval Catholicism, dominating like a pyramid antiquity and succeeding ages. Among theologians, he is undeniably the first, and such has been his influence that none of the fathers, scholastics, or reformers has surpassed it. The great doctor of the Church, the true creator of Western theology, in whom, in a very real sense, medieval thought begins and ends. Quote, his philosophic historical work remains one of the most imposing creations of all time. It posits a capacity and originality of mind which none other possessed either in his own day or for 1,000 years after, end quote, wrote Edward Norden. Far be it from us to pass judgment on such a man or his works. We shall consider not how St. Augustine acquitted himself in his great task, but only what that task was. From what we have already quoted, it would seem that St. Augustine's great significance lies in the final fixing of a new orientation for the Church. Quote, it was to him more than to any other single man, end quote, says McGifford, quote, that the spirit of classical antiquity gave way to the spirit of the Middle Ages, end quote. Quote, the Christian theology and philosophy of the Middle Ages, unquote, according to Grabman, perhaps the foremost authority on that subject, quote, is in form and content almost exclusively Augustinian until late in the 13th century, end quote. And even then, quote, the world historical achievement of St. Thomas was the synthesis of Augustine and Aristotle, end quote. For the medievalist Colton, Augustine is, quote, the man who closes ancient thought and begins medieval thought, end quote. Quote, it is he, end quote, writes Ferdinand Lott, quote, who set the church irresistibly on the course which she has followed to the modern era, end quote. Quote, upon Augustine, Petrarch and the great masters of the Renaissance formed themselves, end quote. Says Harnack, quote, and without him, Martin Luther is not to be understood, end quote. Augustine, the founder of Roman Catholicism, is at the same time the only father of the church from whom Luther received any effective teaching or whom the humanists honored as a hero. Many have called St. Augustine the first man of the modern world. The historian Troeltsch calls him the last man of the ancient. Apparently, Augustine is to be respected before all things as that rarest of all humans, a founder and creator. Grabman says he was, quote, the true creator of the theology of the West, just as Origen, footnote 8, was the founder of the speculative theology of the Orient, end quote. Troeltsch also describes Augustine as continuing the work that Clement of Alexandria and Origen had undertaken two centuries before. The names of Origen and Augustine are often linked together, and with good reason, for each devoted his life to the same project, namely the working out of a Christian theology which he personally could accept. We have already talked about Origen's allegiance to the schools of philosophy, and how it conditioned and inspired his whole effort to develop a theology that would be intellectually respectable. St. Augustine was, if anything, even more of a child of the schools than Origen, who was a far more austere and independent character. For 20 years, Augustine absolutely refused to accept the Christianity learned at his mother's knee, however powerful his sentimental attachments to it, because, as he explains at great length in the Confessions, it simply could not stand up to the arguments of the schoolmen. He tells us how in his youth, after reading Cicero, he would laugh at the prophets, and how from the very first the pagan schools had taught him to abhor any suggestion that God might have a body. It was instruction like that, he says, that convinced him that the Christians could not possibly be right. And this is the significant point. Augustine never changed the ideas and attitudes he acquired in the schools. He did not turn away from them back to Christianity. Rather, he built them firmly and finally into the structure of Christianity before he would accept it. He never came around to accepting, on the one hand, the naive beliefs with which he charged the Christians, nor on the other hand did he ever swerve in his allegiance to the Platonists. According to Professor Grabman, the whole explanation of Augustine's, quote, tremendous influence on the scholasticism and mysticism of the Middle Ages, unquote, lay in the single fact of his being, quote, the greatest Christian Neoplatonists, unquote, whose life work was, quote, the Christianizing of Neoplatonism, end quote. Augustine has described, as few others could, the tension and agony of a 20-year deadlock, quote, a struggle within his breast, end quote, Grabman calls it, between the teachings of the schools and the teachings of the Christians. In the end, something had to give way, and it was the church. It was Augustine, in Lot's words, who, quote, set the church irresistibly on the course, end quote, which she was to follow for the future. It was not the church that drew Augustine into her orbit. Or rather, let us say, this is the classic problem of three bodies, in which the orbit of each alters and is altered by each and both of the others. Augustine, as our experts have declared, brought forth a new Christian theology when he solved the problem of which should prevail, the prophets or the philosophers, by deferring to both, uniting them into a new and wonderful synthesis which has been the object of endless scholarly panegyrics. Editor's note, i.e., formal or elaborate praise. Augustine, wrote Moldseberg, laid the foundation of Western culture when he fused antique civilization and Christianity together once for all in a single mighty mold. Reitzenstein declares that Augustine's life work was, quote, the program of a reconciliation of antique civilization and Christianity, whose synthesis still determines our culture, end quote. This fusion of the classical and Christian heritages was the culmination of a long process. Quote, all the Christian writers, from Justin to Gregory of Nazianzus and from Minucius Felix to Jerome, used the classics to explain, to enrich, and to defend Christianity, end quote, wrote Father Combes in his valuable study of Augustine's education. And this fusion of classic and Christian, quote, attained its perfection in the work of St. Augustine, end quote. Note that the trend begins with Justin and Minucius Felix, Christian converts who had been thoroughly indoctrinated by the schools before ever joining the church, and who remained fiercely and unshakably loyal to the schools to the end of their lives, regarding themselves as the real or esoteric Christians, and poo-pooing the others as an uneducated and uncritical rabble. Editor's note, could there be any doubt today that worldly regarded men such as these, who infiltrated the ancient Christian church and perverted the gospel with the exoteric teachings of the Greek mystery schools, were precisely the kinds of wolves in sheep's clothing that the church leaders of the time were struggling against? Continuing quoting Hugh Nibley, we have noted already how these men thought their fine heathen educations would be a great boon to the church. This is the group to which Augustine belongs. Father Eggersdorfer has shown how he remained up to the end of his life completely a child of the schools. Augustine himself calls the adoption of pagan education, quote, spoiling the Egyptians, unquote, and in his famous De Doctrina Christiana, written at the end of his life, he presents his program for sending the church to school with the rhetoricians and philosophers. In making his perfect fusion of Christian and classic knowledge to produce a doctrinal system which he and his intellectual friends could accept, Augustine, to quote Combes, quote, uses the ancient theodicy, metaphysics, morality, and politics. He often seems to reproach himself for doing this, to be sure, but the protests of his heart are silenced before the implacable dictates of his intellect. It is his desire to endow the church with a doctrine so solidly constructed that she will never again have anything to fear from her enemies. End quote. That is a remarkably revealing statement which deserves some examination. From the first quotation of Combes, we learn that the idea of reconciling Christian with pagan ideas was one that had been current among the intellectuals of the church for a long time. It was anything but the blinding flash of inspiration that some would make it out to be. It wasn't a creeping sense in the church. The idea of a supersynthesis had become an obsession in the schools, where work on the encyclopedic summas of all knowledge had long since brought all original research to a complete halt. In his pre-Christian days, Augustine had displayed a passion for this kind of activity, and it never left him. Next, we learn from Combes that Augustine was not at all happy about what he was doing to the church. Quote, He often seems to reproach himself for this, unquote. Why should he reproach himself unless he knew there was something fundamentally wrong about this program? Monsieur Duchesne opens the third volume of his early history of the Christian Church with this remark, quote, "In uniting itself closely to the state, the Church under Theodosius was not making a good match. It was wedding a sick man soon to become a dying one," unquote. We might paraphrase the sentence to read, quote, "In uniting itself closely to the learning of the state schools, the Church under Augustine was not making a good match. It was wedding a sick man soon to become a dying one," unquote. The two weddings are actually phases of the same movement. For Theodosius's work of consolidation and Augustine's were going on at exactly the same time. Classical learning was a very sick man in Augustine's day, and he knew it. Many authorities have remarked how the saint constantly denounced the arts of the schools while constantly practicing them. This fatal inconsistency has been immortalized in the story of Saint Jerome, Saint Augustine's great contemporary. They died but 10 years apart. Who, in a dream, was chastised by an angel with the awful accusation, "You are not a Christian, but a Ciceronian." And after he awoke, Jerome went right on being a good Ciceronian, as did Augustine to the end of his days. In a recent study, Maru has shown Augustine's own education to be that of a decadent age, and has pointed out that the only change St. Augustine made in introducing pagan education into the church officially was to make the courses even more simple, superficial, and streamlined than they had been, thus contributing to, quote, "that lowering of the general level of civilization which already, all around Augustine, announces the coming age of the barbarians," unquote. Well might Augustine reproach himself for what he was doing, but he had no choice. Quote, "The protests of his heart were silenced before the implacable dictates of his intellect," end quote. What are the implacable dictates that thus override desire? Combes continues, quote, "To endow the church with a doctrine so solidly constructed that she will never again have anything to fear from her enemies," end quote. Never again? To be sure, in the past the philosophers could pick Christian doctrine to pieces. They could show you in black and white that God could never have a son, or that, since he was the totally other, nothing could possibly be in his image, etc. As Peter remarks in the Clementine Recognitions, Simon Magus could always give him a bad time and usually win the argument, but that didn't worry him. The ancient saints were not impressed by the pompous schoolmen, because they had their testimonies. It was because revelation had ceased that Augustine was driven to come to an understanding with the philosophers, who are now feared and respected as possessing the only available key to knowledge. Whence this new attitude, yielding to the implacable dictates of the intellect? The world of St. Augustine's day was willing enough to become Christian, since the emperor's approval and compulsion had made such a course both safe and popular. But the new Christian world community was not willing to fulfill the conditions necessary to receiving revelation, not by a long shot. We can best describe the situation by another quotation from Monsieur Duchesne. Quote, "Long distances separated them," the Christians of St. Augustine's time, "from the spiritual enthusiasm of the early church. Now everyone was a Christian, or nearly everyone, and this implied that the profession involved but little sacrifice. The mass of the community was Christian in the only way in which the mass could be, superficially and in name. The water of baptism had touched it, but the spirit of the gospel had not penetrated its heart. Upon their entry into the church, the faithful invariably renounced the pomps of Satan, but neither the theaters nor the games were deserted. It was a subject on which preachers uttered their most eloquent protests, and all to no purpose. Augustine himself has much to say on this theme." Was it really the church which was overcoming the world? Was it not rather the world which was overcoming the church? Unquote. Whoever was winning, in Augustine's day, the people of the church no longer had testimonies. From now on, they insisted that the gospel be proved to them by intellectual arguments and clever demonstrations. Augustine himself says he wanted to be as sure of its truth as he was sure that 4 and 3 make 7. Like Origen, he wanted to put the doctrine of the church on an intellectual basis, which was the nearest thing to certainty that he could ever get. He was, says Arnold Lunn, the well-known English Catholic, quote, the first of the fathers to realize fully the necessity for a rational foundation of the faith, unquote. And Professor Grabman reminds us that in his theological explorations, Augustine, quote, had almost no predecessors, and for the most part was the very first man to experience the intellectual difficulties of these questions, end quote. For 400 years, during which the philosophers constantly made fun of them, the Christians had failed to realize that their faith should be founded on reason and speak the language of philosophy. Whence this astounding oversight? Why must Augustine be the first to see the light? Obviously, as we have often pointed out on other evidence, the early Christians had a revealed faith and were not interested in things reasoned out by man. Augustine wanted to endow the church with a solidly constructed doctrine, says Father Combes. Hadn't Christ and the apostles already done that? It was certainly not their intention to work out a system that would please the schoolmen. Just before he was put to death, the Lord told his disciples not to be afraid, because he had overcome the world. That was as far as the ancient saints would go. They made no attempt to win popularity with those who would not accept the gospel as it stood. The apostles were instructed, when the people would not accept their teachings, simply to depart and go to others, not to change those teachings under any circumstances into something the world would accept. But that is precisely what St. Augustine did. He, and not the Lord or the apostles, is, in Grabman's words, quote, the true creator of the theology of the West, end quote. What a come down from the days of Revelation. Let us summarize what Father Combes has told us. 1. Augustine found the church without a solid doctrinal foundation. 2. He took it upon himself to study the ark, but who gave him the necessary knowledge or authority to do it? Where did he go for his information? Combes tells us that 3. He went to the pagan schools. He took their theodicy, metaphysics, moral teachings, and politics, and worked them into his system. Is that the proper source for Christian doctrine? 4. That question worried Augustine too, but 5. He had to go ahead with his project because the times required it urgently. And what was the world clamoring for? A theology that would appeal on rational grounds alone to a Christian world which was, as Dushny puts it, Christian in name only, and which had forgotten the meaning of a testimony. The wedding of the sickly philosophy of the 4th century to Christian doctrine could take place only after Christianity had been once for all definitely divorced from the gift of prophecy and revelation. St. Augustine fully deserves his title of the man who changed the whole course of world history and of church history. He found himself in an intolerable situation, and he made the best of it. It is the situation, not the man, that teaches us what hard necessity and fateful decisions faced the church once the gifts of revelation and prophecy were withdrawn. End quote from Hugh Nibley's book. As can be witnessed after the transition which St. Augustine finalized, the practices, rites, and manner of worship of the Catholic Church changed in ways that astonishingly parallel characteristics of other religions whose roots lie in the ancient mystery schools. Celibate monks in drab-colored robes with shaved heads and prayer beads, chanting set prayers and incantations, all startlingly hearkens to near identical aspects of the practices of Chinese Buddhism. In fact, when Catholicism first made its way into the Orient, representatives were extremely startled to witness these similarities and wrote letters back home expressing their dismay. While the Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is still present, the introduction of Mariolatry, i.e., the veneration of Mary, thus creating a Catholicized version of the Ra/Osiris, Isis, Horus relationship. The 12 apostles and various other biblical identities became deified and constitute a Catholic equivalent of a pantheon of immortals, not unlike the qualities and attributes of those of ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome, to which mere mortals can directly offer prayers, instead of addressing the Father in the name of Jesus Christ, usually for specific needs or purposes. The term saint went from referring to a mortal follower of Christ, the equivalent of the definition of a Christian today, to a pinnacle title of impeccable status, sainthood, applied only to those who lived a life honorable and exemplary enough, having met a specific criteria, and who are now deceased. All but a handful of the billions of mortals that have graced this planet could ever hope or dream of achieving such loftiness. Is it not unlike the elite dream of achieving immortality and surmounting the Grecian Mount Olympus? While the term purgatory is nowhere to be found in the Bible, its postulated likeness is uncannily reminiscent of the Grecian concept of Hades. The more one looks, the more it becomes apparent that Roman Catholicism is not much more than an exoteric shell of religiosity, in the same vein as those exoteric shells of ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome, which hides an esoteric core of initiates and secret doctrines deep within. Except in this case, the shell utilizes Christ, His Mother, His Apostles, His Atonement, His good works, as well as twisting His sacred words to mask the Luciferian doctrines deeply concealed within. Is it any wonder, then, that the angel speaking to Nephi labels it as, quote, the most abominable above all other churches, unquote, within the multi-tentacled monstrosity of the Church of the Devil, which holds the entire world in its clutches? LDS Church Office Building Contrasted to the Vatican. Anyone is welcome to travel to Salt Lake City, Utah, and visit the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints headquarters, located adjacent to the temple. It is a sizable, functional structure that is comparatively minimalistic, especially taking into account the headquarters of other worldwide religions. There is nothing terribly extravagant about this location, and the functions that take place within it are similar to any other kind of office-based organizational management. Footnote 9. In 1998, I was employed at the church office building as an information technology contractor. My office was on the 19th floor of the building. As a computer specialist, it was my job to visit everywhere within the building in repairing or deploying computers and components. I can personally attest to the modesty and simplicity of the decor and adornment throughout the entire building. I was considerably surprised to find that the walls, carpeting, decorations, framed pictures, and just about anything both functional and ornamental within the building were no better in quality nor aesthetics than that which is found in any average LDS meeting house anywhere in the United States or throughout the world for that matter. It was quite modest both in decor and equipment, in comparison to what I've witnessed within the halls of several large companies I've worked for over the years. The lobby is possibly the most elaborate part of the building, and yet it is also modest in comparison to the headquarters of other worldwide organizations. Truly, if anyone were to view photos of anywhere inside of the LDS Church's headquarters without being told what they were looking at, they'd likely conclude that it was an average office building. Only the LDS Church's holy temples are lavishly and ornately decorated. Compare that to the Vatican. Quote, Vatican City, or Vatican City State, is a landlocked, sovereign city-state whose territory consists of a walled enclave within the city of Rome, Italy. It has an area of approximately 44 hectares, 110 acres, and a population of just over 800.
This makes Vatican City the smallest independent state in the world by both area and population. Vatican City is an ecclesiastical and sacerdotal monarchical state, ruled by the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. The highest state functionaries are all Catholic clergymen of various national origins. It is the sovereign territory of the Holy See, Sancta Sedis, and the location of the Pope's residence, referred to as the Apostolic Palace. The popes have generally resided in the area since the return from Avignon in 1377, but have also at times resided in the Quirinal Palace in Rome and elsewhere. Previously, they resided in the Lateran Palace on the Caelian Hill, on the far side of Rome from the Vatican. Emperor Constantine gave this site to Pope Miltiades in 313. The signing of the agreements that established the new state took place in the latter building, giving rise to the name of Lateran Pax, by which they are known. End quote. Footnote 10. Consider for a moment. The Vatican is not only its own city, it is its own sovereign government. It makes its own laws, has its own security force, the Vatican Guard, and is surrounded by a massive wall. It is quite possibly the largest, most richly ornate and extravagantly decorated place on earth. Even its streets' drains are astonishingly fancy. What ought to be even more alarming is that its decorations, especially its statuary, not only strongly harken back to those found among the ruins of ancient Greece and Rome, but also contain some highly pagan elements. Just two small examples of such include images of a sphinx and serpents. Footnote 11. Additionally, on the grounds outside the Vatican Museum, there is an imposing piece of art, a large, shiny, gold-colored orb, which is cracked open in some parts, and within it is another shiny, gold-colored orb, also cracked open and exposed down the middle, beginning to protrude out of it. Although expertly crafted, it is not a terribly pleasant-looking structure. Depending upon one's perspective, it could appear to be a very foreboding eye. It could also represent a hidden world concealed within an outward shell, a physical representation of the esoteric concealed behind the exoteric. It can also signify an inner world being born out of an outer world. If there's anything I've learned in my research over the past 6 years, it is this. In Mystery Babylon, there is no such thing as meaningless art. There is always very specific hidden meaning behind everything, which is clearly understood by some level of initiates. Regardless of how anyone else interprets its symbolism exoterically, there is undoubtedly an esoteric inner meaning to this disturbing Golden Globe artistic piece. Bruce R. McConkie and the Mormon Doctrine Saga. Quote, "When the time comes that you are called in and rebuked for something that you did that was right and proper, you stand and take it. You offer no excuses, just take it." End quote. Bruce R. McConkie, advice to his son, Joseph Fielding McConkie. Even if they don't own a copy of it, most Latter-day Saints are familiar with a hefty volume called Mormon Doctrine by Bruce R. McConkie, who was a member of the First Quorum of the 70 when he wrote and published it. It is truly a spectacular and extensive resource outlining how the doctrine of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints applies on a topic-by-topic basis. Interestingly enough, though when it was first published in 1958, it garnered a great deal of controversy and was subsequently pulled from shelves in early 1960. Later, a revised edition was published and released several years later. A great deal of speculation went on as to why that occurred, for a volume with the title of Mormon Doctrine is no small matter. In December of 2003, Bruce R. McConkie's son, Joseph Fielding McConkie, published a biographical recollection of his father called The Bruce R. McConkie Story, Reflections of a Son. An entire chapter, called The Mormon Doctrine Saga, is dedicated to telling the story of what happened with the book's first publication, why it was pulled, and what was changed upon its re-release. The following represents relevant segments of this chapter. Footnote 12. Question: What was all the flap and fuss about Mormon doctrine anyway? Response: The first edition of Mormon Doctrine, released in 1958, caused something of a stir by directly identifying Roman Catholicism as the great and abominable church spoken of by Nephi in the Book of Mormon. The authoritative tone of the book was also a concern, with the question being asked, what right does Bruce McConkie have to speak for the church? The book came in for some criticism because of the strong language in which it denounced marginal practices among Latter-day Saints, such as card games in which face cards were used. Editor's note, there's a good deal of mystic and occult symbology within the suits and face card images of traditional poker decks, and family reunions that were held on the Sabbath. Question, is it true that President David O. McKay banned the book? Response, in January 1960, President McKay asked Elder McConkie not to have the book reprinted. Question, how is it then that the book was reissued? Response, on July 5, 1966, President McKay invited Elder McConkie into his office and gave approval for the book to be reprinted if appropriate changes were made and approved. Elder Spencer W. Kimball was assigned to be Elder McConkie's mentor in making those changes. Question, how do you know President McKay directed your father to reprint Mormon Doctrine? Response, my father told me that President McKay had so directed him. In addition to that, I am in possession of handwritten papers by my father affirming that direction. Question, did the first edition of Mormon Doctrine cause embarrassment to President McKay? Response, yes. The Catholic bishop in Salt Lake City, Bishop Hunt, communicated to President McKay his displeasure with the book and what it said about the Catholic Church. Question, what was Elder McConkie's reaction to that criticism? Response, he agreed that what he had written did not facilitate good relations with our Catholic neighbors. He stated, quote, it wasn't smart on my part, end quote. He had no reluctance in making the changes he made in the second edition of the book. Question, so, at least originally, the first presidency had concerns about Mormon doctrine? Response, yes, one of those concerns was the title itself. There was some question about what business a 70 had declaring the doctrine of the church. Editor's note, Bruce R. McConkie was later called to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in 1972. It is interesting to note, however, that no suggestion was ever made that the title of the book be changed. Question, would it be fair to say that the first presidency gave your father a good horsewhipping for some of the things he wrote in Mormon Doctrine? Response, I think their concern was not as much with what he had written as that he had done it without seeking counsel and direction from those who presided over him. This was back in the day before the Brethren did much writing, and there was no established review system for what they did write. As to their giving him a good horsewhipping, I think we can be confident that they were not shy in voicing their feelings. I have been told that when he met with the first presidency, my father was invited to be seated but chose to remain standing. I also know that it was his practice, because he told me I was to do the same. When you are getting scolded, you offer no excuses. You just take it. After the experience, President Henry D. Moyle of the First Presidency observed, quote, I have never seen a man in the church in my experience that took our criticism, and it was more than criticism, but he took it better than anyone I ever saw. When we were through and Bruce left us, I had a great feeling of love and appreciation for a man who could take it without any alibis, without any excuses, and said he appreciated what we said to him, unquote. Question, so what kinds of things were omitted from the second edition of the book? Response, in a number of instances, the first edition of Mormon Doctrine reached beyond the stated purpose of the book, the Declaration of the Doctrines of Mormonism, to include denouncing various Christian heresies. Entries included the veneration of Mary or Mariolatry, penance, transubstantiation, the notion that in the sacrament the wafer and wine become the actual flesh and blood of Christ, indulgences, and supererogation, which is the teaching that some people perform more good works than are necessary for their salvation, and thus their surplus can be sold to the wicked. This teaching provided the basis for indulgences. Because the purpose of the book was to identify Mormon doctrine, not to catalog heresies, in writing about these things, Bruce McConkie had strayed from his purpose. Hence, such subjects were dropped in the second edition. Question, how extensive was Elder Kimball's list of things that needed changing? Response, there were about 50 items that Elder Kimball wanted Elder McConkie to revisit. Question. Were these doctrinal matters in which he differed with Elder McConkie? Response. No. They dealt with tone and with the wisdom of including particular things. Question. How did Elder McConkie feel about the suggestions made by Elder Kimball? Response. He was very appreciative. Elder Kimball was a wise mentor who taught him the difference between being right and being appropriate. The fact that something is true does not necessarily mean one ought to say it. Question. It has been suggested that the treatment of the Catholic Church may not have been the primary source of the criticism directed at Mormon doctrine, but rather that the standard Elder McConkie held out for the members of the Church caused some to squirm. Is that the case? Response. I think so. It is hard to imagine that a lot of Catholics in Salt Lake City were buying a book entitled Mormon Doctrine and then taking offense at it. The Protestants have been saying worse things about them for 400 years, and it was, for the Catholics, like water off a duck's back. At the same time, marginal practices among members of the Church were addressed strongly by Elder McConkie in the first edition of Mormon Doctrine. For instance, birth control was described as gross wickedness and rebellion against God. Card playing was called apostasy and rebellion. Light speeches in church meetings were described as highly offensive to the Spirit. Elder McConkie was not very adept at tolerating the gray area between right and wrong. Even today, my experience suggests that his unequivocal stand against the Darwinian theory of organic evolution is the primary reason the book has been criticized. In the first edition, he wrote, quote, how scrubby and groveling, changed in the second edition to weak and puerile, the intellectuality which, knowing that the Lord's plan takes all forms of life from a pre-existent spiritual state through mortality and on to an ultimate resurrected state of immortality, yet finds comfort in the theoretical postulates that mortal life began in the scum of the sea, as it were, and has through eons of time evolved to its present varieties and state. Do those with spiritual insight really think that the infinite creator of worlds without number would operate in this way? End quote. The conclusion to this section in both editions is, quote, there is no harmony between the truths of revealed religion and the theories of organic evolution. End quote. Critics frequently attempt to give credence to their objection by finding fault with the author or the book on any count they can. Question. What doctrinal errors were corrected between the first and second editions of the book? Response. I do not know of a single instance in which Elder McConkie was asked to change or chose to change his doctrinal position. The second edition of Mormon Doctrine is a substantially better book. The tone of the book is softer. Articles attacking false doctrines born of apostasy, but not directly germane to Mormonism, have been dropped, and 80 pages of new material have been added. No doctrinal changes were made, however. The essence of each entry remains the same. The report submitted to the First Presidency by Elder Spencer W. Kimball indicates that he checked changes made on 56 pages, all of which he approved. He did not indicate a single instance of doctrinal disagreement with what was written. Again, I know of no single instance in which the doctrine announced in the first edition differed from that of the second edition. Much was changed by the way of tone. Things were simply said more appropriately, but the same things were said. Question. As your father looked back on his life, would he have done anything differently as far as Mormon doctrine is concerned? Response. He did observe on a number of occasions that, perhaps, in writing the book, he had done too much for its readers. Quote, it may have been better for them, end quote, he said, quote, to have been required to find answers for themselves, unquote. Today, if you were to pick up a copy of Mormon Doctrine and look up the subjects Church of the Devil or Great and Abominable Church, you would read the following. Quote, see, apostasy, Babylon, devil, Kingdom of the Devil, Second Coming of Christ, World. The titles Church of the Devil and Great and Abominable Church are used to identify all churches or organizations of whatever name or nature, whether political, philosophical, educational, economic, social, fraternal, civic, or religious, which are designed to take men on a course that leads away from God and His laws, and thus from salvation in the Kingdom of God. Salvation is in Christ, is revealed by Him from age to age, and is available only to those who keep His commandments and obey His ordinances. These commandments are taught in, and these ordinances are administered by, His Church. There is no salvation outside this one true church, the Church of Jesus Christ. There is one Christ, one church, one gospel, one plan of salvation, one set of saving ordinances, one group of legal administrators. Quote, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, end quote. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 5. Any church or organization of any kind, whatever, which satisfies the innate religious longings of man and keeps him from coming to the saving truths of Christ and his gospel, is therefore not of God. Hence we find our Lord saying, quote, he that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad, end quote. Matthew chapter 12, verse 30. And hence we find Alma inviting the wicked to repent and join the true church of Christ, and become the sheep of the good shepherd. Quote, and now, if ye are not of the sheep of the good shepherd, of what fold are ye? End quote. He asks, quote, behold, I say unto you, that the devil is your shepherd, and ye are of his fold. And now who can deny this? Behold, I say unto you, whosoever denieth this is a liar and a child of the devil. Unquote. Alma chapter 5, verse 39, Joseph Smith, chapter 2, verse 19. Iniquitous conditions in the various branches of the great and abominable church in the last days are powerfully described in the Book of Mormon. Nephi saw the church which is most abominable of all other churches in vision. He saw the devil, that he was the foundation of it, and also the murders, wealth, harlotry, persecutions, and evil desires that are part of this organization. 1 Nephi chapter 13, verses 1 through 10. He saw that this church took away from the gospel of the Lamb many covenants and many plain and precious parts, that it perverted the right ways of the Lord, and that it deleted many teachings from the Bible, that it was the mother of harlots, and finally that the Lord would again restore the gospel of salvation. Similar visions were given to John as recorded in the 17th and 18th chapters of Revelation. He saw this evil church as a whole, ruling over peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, as being full of blasphemy, abominations, filthiness, and fornication, as having the name Mystery Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, as drunken with the blood of the saints, as reveling in wealth and the delicacies of the earth, as making merchandise of all costly items, and of slaves and souls of men. And then John, as did Nephi, saw the fall and utter destruction of this great church whose foundation is the devil. In this world of carnality and sensuousness, the great and abominable church will continue its destructive course, but there will be an eventual future day when evil shall end, and the great and abominable church, which is the whore of all the earth, shall be cast down by devouring fire. Before that day, however, desolations will sweep through the earth, and the various branches of the great and abominable church shall war among themselves, and the sword of their own hands shall fall upon their own heads, and they shall be drunken with their own blood. And that's from 1 Nephi chapter 22, verses 13 through 14, and also chapter 14, verse 3. The resurrected Christ gave to the Nephites this test whereby they might distinguish the true church from any other. 1. It would be called in his name. 4. How be it my church, save it be called in my name, he said. 2. It would be built upon his gospel, that is, the eternal plan of salvation with all its saving powers and graces would be had in it. 3. The Father would show forth his works in it, meaning that miracles, righteousness, and every good fruit would abound in it. 4. It would not be hewn down and cast into the fire, as much surely come to pass with the great and abominable church. Quote, if it be not built upon my gospel, and is built upon the works of men, or upon the works of the devil, verily I say unto you, they have joy in their works for a season, and by and by the end cometh, and they are hewn down and cast into the fire from whence there is no return. End quote. The Lord, 3 Nephi, chapter 27, verses 4 through 12, and end quote from Mormon Doctrine. Many LDS who ponder the controversy surrounding the first publication of Mormon Doctrine typically come to the conclusion that anything and everything having to do with the Church of the Devil is found within the Catholic Church and the Vatican, and that the LDS Church leaders were pressured into redefining this entry. However, as you continue reading this book, you will begin to comprehend just how incredibly accurate this revised definition of the Church of the Devil actually is. The Roman Catholic Church is only one part of the great whore of all the earth, and, quite frankly, its outer religious shell is not secret enough nor nefarious enough to the world on a large scale to warrant further exposure in this book. Recall that the branches of Mystery Babylon will war among themselves, and the sword of their own hands shall fall upon their own heads, and they shall be drunken with their own blood. Quote, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. End quote. Jesus Christ, Matthew chapter 12, verse 25. Unfortunately, however, their first targets and victims will be us, those who will not deny that Jesus Christ is the one and only Savior and Redeemer of the world. Footnotes. Number 1. Times and Seasons, Volume 6, Number 1, page 939. Number 2. Sources, Wikipedia, Opus Dei, O-P-U-S, New Word, D-E-I. And Wikipedia, Jesuit, J-E-S-U-I-T. Number 3. Source, http://www.catholic-hierarchy.org/country/xrel.html. Number 4. Refer to the PDF file in the supporting material. Alleged Oath of the Knights of Columbus Connected to Jesuits. -02-15-1913 Congressional Record. Number 5. Source, Wikipedia, Catholic Sex Abuse Cases. Number 6. Wikipedia, First Council, C-O-U-N-C-I-L, of Nicaea, N-I-C-A-E-A. Number 7. Joseph Smith History, 1-19. Number 8. Quote, Origen, that's spelled O-R-I-G-E-N, or Origen Adamantius, was an early Christian Alexandrian scholar and theologian, and one of the most distinguished writers of the early church. Origen excelled in multiple branches of theological scholarship, including textual criticism, biblical interpretation, philosophical theology, preaching, and spirituality. Some of his teachings, however, quickly became controversial. Notably, he frequently referred to his hypothesis of the preexistence of souls. As in the beginning, all intelligent beings were united to God. Origen also held out the possibility, though he did not assert so definitely, that in the end, all beings, perhaps even the archfiend Satan, would be reconciled to God in what is called the apokatastasis, that's spelled A-P-O-K-A-T-A-S-T-A-S-I-S, and it means restitution. Origen's views on the Trinity, in which he saw the Son of God as subordinate to God the Father, became controversial during the Arian controversy of the 4th century. Though a subordinationist view was common among the Antinician fathers, a group who came to be known as Originists, and who firmly believed in the preexistence of souls and the apokatastasis, were declared anathema, editor's note, i.e., detested, loathed, in the 6th century, end quote. Source, Wikipedia, Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. Number 9. Refer to the image files in the supporting material folder, LDS Church Office Building. Number 10. Source, Wikipedia, Vatican City, V-A-T-I-C-A-N, City. Number 11. Refer to the image files in the supporting material folder, Vatican. Number 12. Refer to the PDF file in the supporting material, Mormon Doctrine Saga.